Basic Brewing Radio is sponsored in part by the American Homebrewers Association. Want to get discounts on homebrew supplies and save money at craft breweries? Join the American Homebrewers Association and save at more than 2,300 AHA member deal locations worldwide and online. Members enjoy discounts on pints, food, and merch, and 10 to 30% off online orders. Visit homebrewersassociation.org/basicbrewing to check out the AHA member deals in your area and join the AHA. That's homebrewersassociation.org/basicbrewing to join the American Homebrewers Association to access thousands of members-only discounts. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, March 31st, 2022. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about homebrewing. This week, Chris Colby, author of The Homebrew Recipe Bible and Methods of Modern Homebrewing, walks us through some popular specialty malts and grains as the next installment of our series on recipe development. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. If you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs and our brewer's logbooks. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing, and thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. I've made reservations, or at least I've applied for a press passes for Steve and me for the Homebrewers Conference in Pittsburgh in June. I've made a hotel reservation as well, so looks like it's going to happen. I'm really excited about that. Looking forward to seeing people in real life and tasting real beer. Steve and I are also set to get together this week to shoot a couple of video episodes and record an audio show as well. Time is flying by. It seems like just last week that he was here sampling beers and talking about stuff. We're going to sample my toasted rye Doppelbock and my kettle-soured Brett beer that I started way back on Christmas Day. Those are on the complete opposite ends of the spectrum, pretty much. The Doppelbock, you know, is dark and chocolatey and kind of rich, but at the same time being, you know, very cleanly fermented with the lager yeast. And the kettle sour is light, a bit tart, with a fun and funky Brett character. So I guess we'll do the dark one first since it's less, you know, less funky. Then, after we get through our video shooting, Steve and I will sit down and sample some tinctures that I made with citrus zests, as suggested by listeners to the show. So that's going to be a lot of fun. And I plan on tasting a bonus beer from Ivory Bill Brewing up in Xylem Springs. So you'll have to stay tuned for that. I had some leftover citrus fruit after making the tinctures with the zests. So I went out and found a recipe for it was a lemon custard pie on the YouTube video, but I added some lime in there. Spoiler, boy, that was tasty. I don't bake a lot. I don't make a lot of pies, and there's a reason for that, because I like to eat them. I'm on the lookout for what to brew next. I've been thinking about my 15-minute Amarillo ale recipe that I used to brew a lot, you know, with 6 pounds of a light dry malt extract and a pound of 60 Love of Uncrystal steeped and just boiled for 15 minutes with, you know, a lot of hops added in that 15 minutes. I've got some Simcoe hops that I need to use for something, and that may just be the ticket or the inspiration. Now, let me know if you've brewed anything similar lately that would be fun to brew for the summertime. Whenever I brew, I do it using my Warthog electric brew-in-a-bag system from our friends and sponsors Desiree and Dave of HighGravityBrew.com. I have the 240-volt system capable of brewing up to 10-gallon batches, even though I generally just brew 5. Steve has the smaller 120-volt 5-gallon system. Both of us love our Warthog systems. You know, gone are the days when the wind blew the heat of the propane burner away from the kettle. No more, you know, wrapping the kettle or a Rubbermaid cooler in blankets and quilts, trying to maintain something close to a stable mash temperature. No more guesstimating the amount of boiling water to add to a mash to ramp up to a higher temperature rest. My Warthog system from HighGravityBrew.com takes the pain out of propane and stores away in my basement in a tidy, small footprint. HighGravityBrew.com has single and two and three vessel systems from 5 gallons to 2 barrels, and they themselves brew on a professional electric system at Pippin's Tap Room, so you know what they're doing. You know that they know what they're doing. Use the promo code EBC75BB, that's EBC75BB, to save $75 off your Warthog electric gear, whether you're buying a whole turnkey system or just maybe a Warthog controller if you've already got the rest of the stuff at your house. Use the code EBC75BB to save $75 off your Warthog gear at family-owned and operated HighGravityBrew.com. That's HighGravityBrew.com. Let's take a quick look into the mailbag. Nate from Central Wisconsin writes, just listen to your latest episode on recipe development. One thing that hung me up for a while was crystal/caramel malt. Not necessarily the difference between crystal and caramel, but all the variations of each. For instance, why would you add Cara Pils, Cara Vienna, Cara Munich, Cara Red versus the C20, C40, C60, etc.? Nate says maybe worth a whole show or part of a show talking about caramel malts. Well, Nate, I hope that this week's conversation fits the bill. Chris Colby and I spend a lot of time on crystal and caramel malts, or is it caramel? Depends on where you're from. As we chat about the role of specialty malts and grains in recipe development. Chris Colby, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thanks, James.
We're in the third or fourth, I've already lost track, segment of the recipe development, and this time we're going to break it down even further in the grain bill. We talked about base malts the first time that you and I got together to talk about grain, but now we're moving over to the buckets with the multicolored, you know, the darker, a little bit darker over in the grains. We're talking about specialty grains or specialty malts, and when we get into this territory, what are we talking about?
Yeah, for like, and I'm not a brewing historian, so this is sort of, I don't take this as gospel, but like back in the old day when they made malts, they were all sort of dark-ish, given the malting process, and but they still had enzymatic power or whatever. And then as maltsters got better and better at producing pale-colored malts, people started liking paler-colored beers, and the sort of the brownish malts of the past went away, but then people still wanted beer with some darker colors. They wanted to have the, and so brewers developed what we now call specialty malts as a way to you start with a beer that's brewed with pale malt, which you know has a lot of enzymatic power, has a high amount of extract, potential extract, and it's a way to take a beer brewed with that and add a little bit of some other some colored malt and add flavors and colors and potentially other attributes to the beer.
So the bulk of the beer is going to be your base malts, like we talked about last time. But the specialty malts and the specialty grains are going to add some fermentables, add some color, add some mouthfeel, you know, add a lot of characteristics that will kind of take those plain base malts and turn them into more interesting beers, so to speak.
Right. Yeah.
And you don't have to have a lot of specialty grains or specialty malts to really make a difference.
Generally not. And I mean, it should be mentioned, you don't need specialty malts at all if you're just going to brew a completely pale beer, mm-hmm. you know, something like a Helles or a German Pilsner beer. Generally wouldn't have much, if any, of any sort of specialty malt. It'd just be all the base malt. But specialty malts, if you want something that's, you know, anywhere from deep golden to jet black, you need some malts in there to get the color up. And then if you want, there's, you know, various specialty malts have different flavors. And if you want those, you know, you've got to go to the specialty malts.
And generally, there may be an exception or two, but specialty grains or specialty malts are, don't do well by themselves in the mash tun.
Yeah, most of them you want to mash. There are some, you know, most specifically like crystal malts, which are a type of caramel malt. Those you can just steep, and that's, you know, that was a big help in the early days of home brewing when people made, you know, beer from like 2 cans of malt extract and you know, a pound of crystal 40. But most of them you have the kilning to get the dark color has killed all the enzymatic power, so you need to mash these grains so that they don't any stray unfermentable or unfermentable carbohydrates get dealt with in the mash.
So you can steep these either outside the mash tun, or if you're doing an extract beer, you can steep these in a bag, like we used to do when we first started brewing, and still get a delicious beer. But also you can do things like delay adding some of these to the mash. Like if you want to add, you know, especially darker grains later in the mashing process, if you're trying not to extract, you know, say astringency, you can add them, you know, during the lautering process. Or you can do, like we talked about with the episode with Matt Giovannisi, a cold steep separate from the mash tun, you know, if you want to do something interesting like that. So there are some different ways that you can play with specialty grains and specialty malts to kind of get different effects.
Yeah, there's a lot you can do. I think one of my favorite variants, if you're going to be doing an extract-based beer, is to turn it into a partial mash beer. That way you take you've got your specialty grains, but you add some pale malt along with them, and then you steep, quote-unquote, those grains at, you know, in the mashing range, you know, generally around 148 to 162 Fahrenheit, and, you know, sort of in the mashing relative thickness, which, you know, is like sort of, you know, an oatmeal-like consistency almost, a little bit lower. And, you know, steep those for you know, 30 minutes or something like that. You can do it in a separate pot, or you can do it in your kettle if you put all those in like a big bag. And then just when you're done with steeping those, the pale malt along with the crystal malts, okay, you've actually mashed that and you've actually made wort. So just pour that off, you know, strain out the grains, and then add your, you know, malt extract later in the boil.
But you can get carried away when you're designing a recipe. You can get carried away with adding too much specialty grains or specialty malts, right? I guess it depends on the style, and it depends on the you know, what you're adding in there. But you can definitely go too far.
You can, yeah, as with anything. And I mean, it depends critically sort of on what you want to do. Like, if you... I've brewed beers before, say with 100% smoked malt, and for a lot of people that was, you know, that would be just way, way, way too much. But for me, it was like, yeah, that's pretty good. That's what I was shooting for. So, you know, you just got to know what you're doing. Like, you know, in the early days of homebrewing, there were a lot of sort of amber ales brewed with like a relative, what we'd think of now as a very high amount of like crystal malt in it. And these produced, you know, they were very full bodied, you know, dark amber colored or whatever. And, you know, but they might have had 15 or, you know, even 20% the grain bill is crystal caramel malt. And now, you know, nowadays we'd say, you know, between 5 and 10 is going to be better in most cases.
Where you might, you know, some of these have unfermentable sugars in the specialty malts, and then you get, you know, this sweetness that doesn't go away, you know, that doesn't ferment out. So you might, you know, especially if you're having like a lower gravity beer and a bunch of unfermentable sugars at the end of it, you can get a kind of a sickeningly sweet beer that is really unbalanced.
Yeah. So you just need to know whatever, you know, if you're adding specialty malt, you need to know what's going to bring to the beer and what do you want, And, you know, so there's also, you know, there's a couple of mistakes you can make. I think one is adding just too much, you know, a percentage of the grain bill, having too much specialty malts in some cases. But you can also, you know, I've seen some people have homebrew recipes, or it's just like every specialty malt made, you know, makes it on the list somewhere. And, you know, my thought is like, what is that going to taste like? You know, are you able to pick out? And my sort of rule, which doesn't have to be everyone's rule, but my sort of rule when I brew, if I'm making a beer and it has, you know, multiple different malts, I'm going to want each of those to contribute something that's noticeable.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not, you know, like some people say, oh, yeah, just a hint of this and a blah, blah, blah. And it's like nobody notices just a hint of anything, you know. I mean, they just don't. Even people with good palates, you know.
Yeah, a hint of, say, something like a debittered black malt or something like that can make a difference in the color, I would say.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But not necessarily the flavor.
Yeah. And I mean, maybe in some cases, if you've got a good beer and it just needs just a tiny bit of something. Like I used to have a porter that I used to add brewer's licorice to. And I was, at the time, I was sort of convinced that that little thing gave it the... you know, the extra little, you know, push over the edge that it needed. And then I ran out of brewer's licorice and brewed it once without it. And I was like, yeah, this tastes fine. I don't really notice that much of a difference. So, yeah.
Just wave it over the kettle next time. And so let's get into a list of specialty malts. The first thing that comes into my mind are the crystal/caramel malts. And I guess the first thing we got to do is make a definition as to what the difference is between a crystal malt and a caramel malt.
Bob Hansen from Breese has a web page that where he explains it all. And basically what he says is that caramel malts are malts that have caramelized sugar on the inside of them. And they can be made, they're made from, you take grain that's been malted, but it hasn't been dried before it's kilned, or it hasn't been dried before it's heated, and you can heat it either by kilning or by roasting. And malts made that way are called caramel malts, but some of the roasted caramel malts are called crystal malts. Crystal malts is a subset, but the basic idea is they're all caramel malts. They've all got sugar that's been caramelized in the middle. Because the grains are wet when they were starting to be heated by whatever method, the sort of thing that goes on in your mash goes on inside the grains themselves, turns to sugar, and then they ramp up the heat at the end, and that produces all the Maillard products that other malts have, but also since there's just the raw sugars inside there, it caramelizes them and. Hence the name caramel malt.
And you can do this at home yourself. And there's a video, if you look on our YouTube channel, you can make your own crystal malt. And therefore, you could make your own, say, Maris Otter crystal malt if you wanted to, or experiment with different base malts. But you essentially get the grain wet and hold it in the oven at mashing temperature. And, you know, so that there is, you know, the sugars inside the grains are... converting into their, you know, from the starches into sugars, and then you can just roast them in the oven to the temperature or the color temperature that you like. You know, that's going above and beyond, and it's definitely something you don't want to do all the time, or maybe you do, but it's a fun experiment where you can, you know, kind of not exactly duplicate what they're doing at the maltster, because, you know, they're taking the grain that hasn't been, or the malt that hasn't been dried yet.
Yeah, they use cream malt. Yep.
And you're rehydrating it to do that on your
right.
own.
You're taking malt that's already gone all the way through the malting process, and then, yeah, adding another step it will work. You know, if it works and produces something that you like, then sure.
Yeah. Take a minute to talk about our friends and sponsors at Imperial Organic Yeast. It's easy for me to talk about them because I'm such a big fan. I always felt compelled to use a starter with a previous brand of liquid yeast that I used to use because I didn't like the lag times. from pitching from the package. However, with 200 billion cells in each easy-to-open pouch of Imperial Organic Yeast, my stir plate is dusty because I don't use it anymore to make starters for moderate gravity 5-gallon batches. Even the big Doppelbock that I lagered in my basement, you know, started out at like 1071. It was just fine with no starter at lager temperatures. I like to say my airlocks are usually bubbling before bedtime with ale pitches. That lager was bubbling before breakfast. Imperial's so confident in their yeast's quality and health that their recommended shelf life is 4 months, and have even gone beyond that, personally. And they've got excellent customer and technical support if you have any questions about your fermentations. Ask your local homebrew shop about Imperial Organic Yeast and check them out at imperialyeast.com. That's imperialyeast.com. So crystal malts and caramel malts, they come, and I should say that I read an experiment recently on the Brewlosophy blog where they compared a UK caramel malt and a U.S. crystal malt, and they statistically couldn't tell the difference in their tasting panel. So you can almost use those interchangeably, those two items in your recipe. But they're roasted or they're kilned to collar temperatures all the way down from right near base malt color to way dark.
Yeah, there's there's some very light colored caramel malts. Caramel Pils is one. So I think it's also called dextrin malt sometimes. So it's very light in color. But it's still got the sugars inside, and that adds just a little bit of, a little bit of color. And then it's all the way up to, there's, malts like Special B that are like 150 Lovibond, and, all through the, there's in the 30 range, in the 40 range, in the 60 range. And they, the higher the color, the progressively darker color they are. Going through, 30, 40, 60 are good for making amber beers. The higher ones, 90, 120, 160 have some brown aspects to it. And they also just taste different because they've been, roasted longer, roasted or kilned, depending on how they're made. Yeah, so you got a wide range of colors to choose from. You've got different and generally progressively more intense flavors as you go up the scale, and they all contribute fermentable carbohydrates, but they also very notably contribute unfermentable carbohydrates too. So the more of any caramel type malt you add to your grain bill, the higher your final gravity is going to be. Mm-hmm. If you had a beer that was made entirely from pale malt and one that was made from like 80% pale malt and 20% caramel malt, fermented with the same yeast, same pitch rate, same everything, the all pale malt one is going to finish at a much lower final gravity than the one with the jacked caramel in it.
So you're adding mouthfeel and a bit of flavor. On the lower, the lighter end of the scale, you're not going to be adding a lot of different flavor. But, if you get a 120 Lovibond crystal malt, you're going to be adding body and like raisiny, dark fruit, characters that are going to be really noticeable in your beer. And would you scale the percentage? I guess it depends on the style you're looking for, but would you scale the percentage contributed to the malt bill depending on the Lovibond color? For instance, would you add less of, say, 120 Lovibond crystal than you would in, say, a 10 Lovibond crystal?
Well, that's interesting because, a lot of people ask, I've heard people say, like, oh, my homebrew shop's out of crystal 30. Can I add just half as much crystal 60? Mm. And you can. Color-wise, that'll work out. But, you're adding fermentable, unfermentable carbohydrate-wise, the weight is going to be play a big role there. And also, whereas you might get the color, one made with a pound of of Crystal 30 and half a pound, another beer made with a half a pound of Crystal 60, color's probably going to be pretty close, but the flavor might differ some.
Mm.
You know, for example, if you wanted, maybe you wanted a beer that was fairly deep, deeply amber colored, but you wanted it reasonably dry, then you maybe use a small amount of, you know, a higher colored crystal malt or caramel malt. But maybe, you know, maybe on the other hand, you wanted it sort of that same color, but you wanted it to have a lot of unfermented, you know, unfermented stuff in it, then add a larger amount of a lower color.
And if you've got like a, if you're making like a barley wine, you know, and you're scaling up, say, you know, a pale ale, and you're making like a, you know, a double IPA or a barley wine or something like that, you wouldn't necessarily scale up your crystal malt proportionally because you're already going to have a higher finishing gravity, you know, since it's a bigger beer. And it seems like to me that you wouldn't want to like double the amount of crystal malt that you in your double IPA, you know. Yeah.
And definitely a double IPA, you wouldn't. You'd want to basically do away with it, any special malts, or at least get them to a low level in a barley wine, you know, you'd want to keep the level low, like maybe as you know, amount, the same amount you'd use in a pale ale, but not anymore, just mm-hmm. because just add more and maybe even less, because you know, and depending on how you collect and process your wort, if you completely sparge the grain bed and then have to, you know, have to boil down 10 gallons down to 5, that's going to add, you know, color and unfermentability to the, is that a word? Unfermentability?
Sure.
to the wort. It is now.
In my pale ale malt bill used to be, you know, 10 pounds or 4.5 kilograms of just American pale two row, and then 1 pound of 60 Lovibond crystal, or 450 grams of, you know, 60 Lovibond crystal. And that was just my go-to, you know, simple pale ale malt bill. And I haven't done that in a while, but it made for some tasty beers. So that's a little less than 10% of that malt bill. You said that that you could sometimes put up to 20% of crystal malt in there. That seems like a lot.
That'd be the top end. I mean, people have done it. I don't think I'm very sure you wouldn't find many commercial beers with that. But, you know, as homebrewers, you know, if that's what you want, go for it. But, like, sort of typical for a pale ale, say, around 10% of the grain bill is pretty much how it goes. If you've read most, say, Sierra Nevada clones, they're, you know, 9 pounds of pale malt and a pound of crystal, you know, either crystal 40 or crystal 60, you know, something in that ballpark at least. So, but you know, for an amber, a little more sweet, a little more full bodied, yeah, you could bump that up a little bit. And again, for me, 20 would be way too much. I like drier beers. So like if I'm making a barley wine, it's pale malt and just a tiny amount of colored malts, because I figure it's already going to, you know, it's already going to finish high.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that crystal malts and caramel malts are some of my favorite specialty grains. It seems like the color range is so diverse and wide, and the flavors that you get out of it are nice, and, you know, especially it gives you a bit of mouthfeel. So for most of my homebrewing career, you know, that's where I've lingered the the most in my recipes, you know, and in the bins. But there are a ton of other specialty malts out there, specialty grains. I keep saying specialty grains because there are a couple of these things that aren't malts, but we'll get into that in a little bit. So let's talk. Anything else you want to say about crystal malts or caramel malts?
Yeah, well, like you said, they're very popular. Probably along with roasted grains as you know, the two big, you know, classes of specialty malts. And I mean, I remember there was a time in homebrewing when like basically every recipe had had some caramel malt presence to it, just because people thought apparently, you know, that you just automatically needed to add some, You know, a little later, people started realize, oh, you know, it doesn't, you know, if you don't want caramel flavor, don't add caramel malt, you know. But they're certainly, yeah, the most, one of the largest, most diverse and most popular classes of, or groups of specialty malts.
And especially if nowadays we're, you know, our ABV tolerance has gone up. But in the, you know, in the beginning, if you're making like a 4% pale ale or something like that, some, you know, a bit of crystal malt would help you on your mouthfeel and, you know, make the beer a bit more substantial. But as I think as the gravities have gone up, maybe they're less, you know, the people lean on them a little less than they used to.
Also, the real old school homebrewing recipes that were just malt extract and then steeped caramel malt, you get the aroma of actual malt in your beer from steeping the caramel malts, because the malt extract itself, that's most of those aromatics have been blown off in the concentration period when they boil it down under super low pressure and not very high temperature. But you still, you know, the most aromatic compounds within that get, you know, go out the smokestack.
Let's move on to melanoidin/aromatic malts. What are those?
Yeah. Also, there's in German some are called brow malts. They're basically just, I like to just think of it as a multi malt. You know, if you want something that tastes, you know, and you know what taste is described as malty, you know, where like a beer made from all Pilsner malt is going to have a light malty taste. If you make it from all Vienna malt, it's going to have a slightly more malty taste. If you make it from, you know, all Munich, it's a slightly more malty taste. Like melanoidin is sort of a concentrated version of, you know, a dark Munich. Although you can add quite a bit of it to your malts. And some people say, at least some homebrewers I've heard say, that it sort of substitutes for a decoction mash. If you want your beer to taste like it's been decocted, a little bit of melanoidin malt will do that for you. And so, you know, it adds a little bit of reddish color at high amounts. And you can add quite a bit, up to 20, you know, around 20% is not uncommon. And I don't know, I've read some places that you can do up to 50. I've never done that myself.
Wow.
And that, yeah, it seems to be like blowing your doors off with the maltiness. But again, you know, if you're a home brewer, why not? If that's what you want. So yeah, it adds some color and some malty, you know, malty flavors.
I added a pound of it to my toasted rye Doppelbock that I just put on tap the other day. Of course, I haven't brewed the recipe without it, so I don't know what the difference is. But, you know, I think Charlie Papazian, when we interviewed him at his house, I think that was one of his secret tricks back then was adding a bit of melanoidin to, you know, to get that decoction whang or whatever you might want to call it.
Yeah, it shows up in a lot of sort of German beers along with a healthy dose of Munich. You know, you put a decent amount of Munich, and then for the kicker, you put in, you know, a little bit of melanoidin malt on top of that.
Biscuit or victory malt?
Yeah, biscuit malt's pretty easy to describe. It tastes like biscuits. So if you're like, hey, I like biscuits and I want the taste of biscuits in my beer, well,
now,
there's a malt for you.
Are these American like breakfast biscuits, or are these, you know, like UK sugary treat biscuits? That's the question.
That's a good question. I think it's more the UK thing, because it's biscuit is a or most malts labeled biscuit are UK malts, and victory is a, I think that might even be a trademark, a Brees, like, but it's the same malt. Or the same, you know, shooting for the same thing. But yeah, these are, there are certain English ales that have quite a bit of biscuit in them. And if you were to taste it and someone would say that's biscuit malt, like, you'd never in your life forget what that's like. There was a guy in my homebrew club who used to love biscuit malt. And so he brewed all these English ales, and they're all, he was good. He was a good brewer, but it's just like you tasted them, you know, when a beer was coming around, you're like, oh, I know who brewed this. This tastes like biscuits. Yeah.
So
this is a, yeah, this is just a malt just kilned a little bit different to give it the biscuit-like flavor. And they're generally, they don't add a ton of color, a little bit more. They're a little darker than pale malts, but not by a ton.
Traditionally, how much, you know, what percentage of the malt bill would this make up?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I would, for me, 15% would be like the, that's, you know, biscuit lover.
Son of a biscuit eater.
Probably, you know, probably if I was going to brew something with it, I'd probably be more like 2.5%, you know, because like a little bit of that for, to me, can be really good. But too much of it is just like, it's just, you know, but that's... That's my personal preference, and doesn't have to be everyone else's.
Moving down, or darker in the color, we have brown malt and or amber malt.
Yeah, these are two malts that used to be, prior to pale malts being, you know, widely produced, these were two types of malts that are, you know, they're basically just, they're malted in the normal way, and then they're just kilned to that color. And historical versions... they were killed in such a way that they still had their enzymatic power. You could you could brew with 100% brown malt in the old days, and it'd still convert itself. Generally, unless you're finding a maltster that's doing some special historical version, you know that's not going to be the case now. And so they're just going to be a darker color. And brown malt, you see it in a lot of sort of porter and brown ale recipes, especially those that are trying to mimic historical beers. And amber malt, you know, you can see it in sort of milds or, you know, some bitters and brown ales. You know, they're both very, very British-y malts. And then, you know, if you're making very sort of English-style ales, those are two malts that, if you can find them, you can consider.
I like the character of brown malt. It's a like a toast. To me, it's toasty. You know, it's like a toasted bread kind of a thing on my palate. It adds a nice little layer of you know, complexity. You know, in a brown beer.
Yeah, what is it? Fuller's Porter. Like every clone recipe I've ever seen of it, it has a lot of brown malt in it. It's that sort of not quite. It makes the dark beer, but not quite as aggressively roasty.
How much would you put in of either the brown or the amber? I guess it depends on the style.
Yeah, brown malt, I mean, in the old days, you could go up to 100%. These, you know, I would say, and this is just me, but I'd say about 25% in a modern beer is all you'd want to use, and then round it out if needed with other roasted malts.
Wow.
Or dark malts. So 25% maybe, and maybe like 10 to 12 would be more of a reasonable range, I would think. And then amber malts less, that tends to be a little bit more sort of gives aggressive, weird, you know, quote unquote weird flavors at too high, you know, at 5, maybe up to 7.5. Interesting, though. I mean, if you like it, then go ahead and add more.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you're a home brewer. It's your beer. You can do what you want. Our friends Ricky and Kelly of Groenfell and Havoc Meaderies in Vermont are releasing something brand new that they're very excited about. It's a tea-based mead called Smoke on the Mountain. If you follow Groenfell on the socials, you might have seen a picture of a glass of Smoke on the Mountain next to the fermenter that's been its home. Smoke on the Mountain is a limited release and is available for pre-sale right now on Groenfell.com, so you might want to get in there. Who knows how long it'll last? It's described as a mellow cup of tea enhanced by smoky pepper, bright hibiscus, and juicy lemon, brewed with maple-infused Merkin chili and hibiscus from Runamuck maple, then rounded out with Ceylon black tea and lemon. And now that's a fun-sounding spring and summer drink if I've ever heard one. And at 5.2 ABV, it would be great for sipping on the porch or maybe dangling your feet in the lake on a dock. Check out Smoke on the Mountain along with all the other honey-based deliciousness at family-owned and operated Grunfell.com. That's Grunfell. Roasted malts, going even darker, roasted malts and grains.
There's a lot of malts that are very highly roasted. There's chocolate malts, and those come in a range from sort of very lightly, a 250 Lovibond to, sort of a more traditional English or more modern traditional English chocolate malt around 350, and then some of them even go up to 500. And then you've got just plain roasted malt too. And then you've got black patent malt, which is the same thing, essentially, black malt. And then you've also got roasted unmalted barley, mm-hmm. which is used a lot in dry stouts. And there's also roasted wheat malts, and there's, any type of malt that's made, base malt that's made, rye, somebody's made a roasted version of it. You might not be able to find it, but like, I know roasted wheat malts are pretty easy to find these days. Those got somewhat popular in the past and haven't gone away.
Yeah. Would you characterize like a debittered, like a midnight wheat or something like that in the, roasted malt category?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I think that's also with roasted malts, just like you said, there's the debittering or dehusked versions, which are supposedly, the same malt, but less aggressively flavored.
Less acrid, I guess.
Which is another, yeah.
Yeah, to me, chocolate malt is more coffee than chocolate, maybe?
Yeah, like a lot of malts, the name of it, you can't assume that it tastes, exactly like the description. Caramel malts are pretty close. You definitely get a hint of caramel, but like biscuit malts, again, it's like, what kind of biscuit is this? And chocolate malt is one where, it doesn't really make a cacao flavored, it's the roasting profile is similar to the roasting profile of cacao nibs that become processed into chocolate, but the flavor is different. And then also in chocolate malts, there's a whole range of colors and different maltsters, and you can get two malts labeled chocolate malt, and they can be actually fairly different.
Mm. And black patent gets the tag of being ashy sometimes, but we've done experiments and tastings with black patent, and to me it's more sweet than ashy. I don't get like an acrid, ashy character out of black patent. It's a sweeter kind of dark character.
Yeah, black patent is interesting, or black malt. It got a really bad reputation in early home brewing. People say like, oh, you can't add more than a couple percentage of it, and it's acrid and burnt. And here's the thing: it's not acrid or burnt. I mean, acrid and burnt describe something, are descriptors for something that have been combusted. Mm. Okay. And black patent malt, if it combusts in the roaster, that that burns up and they don't sell it. They make sure it doesn't. It's very darkly roasted, that's for sure. And it's an intense roast flavor, but that's different than acrid or burnt. And another interesting thing about it, unlike roasted barley, which is unmalted, all the aromatics from black patent malt get a leave from the roaster. Mm. And so it's actually, if you take a handful of roasted barley, just roasted unmalted barley, like the kind you use for stouts, and put it to your nose, it's like, oh, that smells like coffee. But if you take the same size handful of black patent, you smell like it really doesn't smell like anything.
Mm.
And it's, you can use it as a flavor malt. Like Sierra Nevada stout used to be black malt was their dark. And it actually had a very sort of mellow roastiness to it. Another thing that black malt is great for, black malt or black patent, is you know, I love it for like color correction. If you've got a beer and like, yeah, this looks pretty good, but like a couple shades darker, but you don't want to change the flavor. Yeah, put in, you know, a couple ounces for a 5 gallon batch, put in a couple ounces of Black Patent, two or three, and you'll bump it to like one, you know, one color darker.
And so how much of a percentage, what's the upper end? Like if you're making a porter or a stout of, you know, the roasted malts and grains, would you put in there?
Around 10%. Like if you're brewing, you know, the classic sort of Guinness clone for homebrewers is 90%, you know, malts and then the flaked barley and then, you know, 10% roasted barley. So that's right around 10%. A lot of porters too, you know, there will be a mix of, say, chocolate and one of the, you know, either black malt or roasted barley, and, you know, right around 10% for beers, right around 5% ABV, about 10% roasted malt gives you, you know, a dark beer. And then if you're making bigger, stronger ones, imperial stouts, they can add considerably more percentage wise of the dark grains. Because it'll take it, you know.
So that's another example of you know, people who may not know much about, you know, beer recipes may think that, you know, that's such a dark beer. It's got to be like, you know, half of the malt bill's got to be dark stuff, you know, but it's not. It's like mostly, you know, the vast, you know, majority of the grains are pale going in there. It's just that it's just a small amount of these deeply dark malts and grains can really make a huge impact on the beer.
Yeah. Then they also multiple different maltsters make extracts, like liquid extracts of these very dark grains that are, it's actually the you know, they turn it into wort and cook it down, and you can add, I know Brees has one and Weyermann has one, and, you know, you can add the small amounts of these liquids, and, you know, it turns, the color changes very drastically, but they're typically very relatively flavor and aroma neutral. I mean, if you dumped in a bunch, you would eventually get it, but...
Acidulated / acid / sour malt.
Yeah. These are basically just pale malts that have then been sprayed with a liquid that contains like a bunch of lactic acid bacteria. Then that just sort of soaks into the husk. And when you stir it into your mash, it just drops the pH. It's, I think it's basically a workaround for people who want to be Reinheitsgebot compliant, because you can't just go add, you know, there's no paragraph about acids in the, you know, it's just malt, hops, water. But if you have acid malt, you add a little bit of that and it'll drop your pH if you need it. So, and that adds, you know, it's a pale malt. It adds no color basically. Or, you know, no more than like a Pilsner malt would. And you know, it's used in small amounts because you're just adjusting, you know, generally just used for adjusting the mash pH. So like 5% is probably the most, you know, depending on your water that you would ever want to add to that.
And I think a lot of people use a bit of acidulated or sour malt in their kettle sours, you know, to start the pH to be lower, you know, so that the lactobacillus can have sort of a head start on the the kettle souring process.
Yeah, you essentially just like adding acid or adding lactic acid bacteria. Sorry.
Smoked malts. Now, you know, we're talking about these as specialty malts, but you and I both have made 100% smoked malts beers. Mine was using smoked malt from Sugar Creek Malting Company, and their smoked malt was delicious, but not as smoky. It didn't smell as smoky, you know, in its grain form as the, you know, the bins at the homebrew store do. You know, it's way smoky, but it's not like overpowering. I still have a couple of bottles of that in the fridge, and I think when you and I are done talking, I think I'm going to go get one because that sounds good right about now. But the smoked malt, at least, you know, the ones that we've used have enough enzymatic power to be base malts, but they're most likely or most often used as an adjunct or as a specialty malt in smoked beers.
Yeah, because it's almost always, you know, pale malts that are smoked over hardwood, although there are a few peat smoked malts. And, you know, like Schlenkerla rock beers are sort of the, you know, one of the more famous versions of that. And that brewery still actually smokes their own malt over beechwood. And the Alaskan smoked porter, you know, sort of the first, you know, American smoked beer that made some, you know, some splashes in the beer culture here, they go to a salmon fishery and smoke their malt over alder. And, you know, so it's usually pale malts over hardwood. And, you know, there are cherry smoked malts available commercially, probably others. You know, you can use pecan, you can use apple, you know, basically if you're, you know, if you're a barbecuer and you know, what different hardwood smokes, you know, you could smoke your own malt. And it's fun. I've done that. You just take a screen door, mm-hmm. you know, screen door mesh, not painted or anything, just raw screen door stuff, cut it so it fits over the grate of your grill, and, you know, just very lightly wet your, you know, just like with a spray bottle, your malt and spread it out and then put some, you know, have some smoke underneath it.
Yeah. Yeah, I've done that too. And that way you could do, you know, like a hickory smoked beer or an applewood smoked beer, you know, or something that you might not be able to find commercially. But boy, the Alaskan smoked porter, that's a tasty beer.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
I personally love the Schlenkerla beers. I mean, I remember the first time I tried that, I was just like, oh my God, what is this? This is awesome. It's like people either – the funny thing about smoked beers, and I think we've even mentioned this on the show before, but people either love them or hate them.
Mm-hmm.
People are like, oh, wow, this is like tasting a campfire. And then other people are like, oh, this is like tasting a campfire.
Yeah, I went to the Great American Beer Festival, and the Alaskan brewery had a vertical tasting. They had, you know, like the current year – and then 2 years previous, and then 2 years previous to that of their, you know, their smoked porter. And boy, that was fun. I usually don't encourage people to age their beers. You know, a lot of times, especially if they're big, you know, hoppy beers, I like to drink them fresh. But the way the smoke character evolved over time, it was really interesting and really delicious. So. You know, it's neither here nor there, but that's something that you might think about.
Yeah, and I mean, smoke has been used to preserve foods for a while, so maybe it may. You know, I've never read any actual studies about it, but maybe it helps. And I know, like, a weird thing about smoked beers, I know they have the reputation that the smoke character can kind of come and go. Like if you brew a batch and you tried one beer of it a week. You know, some weeks it'd be like, oh, this seems pretty, you know, smoky. And other weeks it would seem less so. And, you know, I don't know if that's verifiably scientifically correct, but it's certainly, I've heard that opinion more than once.
Well,
smoked beers, I would agree.
In that vertical tasting, the smoke character didn't diminish over time, but it did. I wish I had took some tasting notes or something, but it seemed like it was like more fruity over time. And that may be because, you know, maybe there was a little bit of a staling in the malt, you know, character, some, you know, a little bit of oxidation, maybe, I don't know. But yeah, it was delicious. So you've got one more item on our list, but I think that might fit into our next conversation about adjuncts.
Yeah. Cause this isn't a malt. Yeah. It's just it's not really roasted or done anything to other than, well, like,
yeah, no spoilers. We can't spoil it. We gotta let's save that one for next time. And there are a ton of specialty malts and specialty grains coming out, especially, you know, with the small roaster or the small maltsters coming on board. But this is, you know, this is kind of a good basic discussion about what, you know, what people are looking at, you know, when they go in the homebrew store. So I think that's another good chapter to the series.
I agree.
Awesome. Look forward to the next time. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thanks again to Chris. I think we're making progress on this recipe development topic. We'll dive even deeper next time. Let me know what you want to hear along these lines. In the meantime, if you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. In the meantime, stay well and stay tuned. So long.